The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, WSFM LP Asheville, or Friends of Community Radio.
You're listening to Asheville FM at WSFM LP at 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Bursa Goodness.
The Final Straw can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWALP in Olympia, Washington, WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, and Berkeley Liberation Radio. Archives of The Final Straw can be found at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, where you can explore our 5 years of past programming, and you can write to us with questions or comments at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net.
A regular spot on the show is weekly commentary by anarchist prisoner Sean Swain, currently incarcerated at the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility in Lucasville. At the moment, Sean's outgoing communication is being blocked and messed with in response to Sean making public statements on behalf of a fellow inmate who is being unduly persecuted. The info that Sean's supporters released and acted on led to an end to the punishment of the other prisoner and to the silencing of Sean. You can find out more about Sean, his case, and how to contact him, and the year plus of his commentaries at seanswain.org.
And here are some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain.
What you say, what you say, what you say, what? I'll call like a boss!
Stanley Milgram was a shrink who proved hierarchs are crazy. That wasn't his intention, of course. He did it purely by accident. He was a card-carrying devoted hierarch himself. Milgram's intention was to prove that the inhumanity of the Nazis in World War II was strictly a German thing, something anomalous to their culture, or their politics, or maybe their water. But that was his aim, to prove it couldn't happen here, or anywhere else. So Milgram set up an experiment. One that he hoped would prove that ordinary people would resist following immoral orders to harm or kill others. He set up a test situation, hoping to prove subjects would not blindly follow orders they themselves find morally objectionable. Here's how it went. The subject was seated at a control panel with buttons and dials, and was led to believe that somewhere out of view another participant was hooked up to electrical wires. The subject was told that if he or she hit the button on the control panel, the other participant would receive a shock. This wasn't true, of course. The other participant was really an actor, just pretending. No one actually got hurt. But the subjects at the control panel didn't know that. Subjects believed the experiment was designed to see if electric shock improved memory and would read off questions. When the other participant got an answer wrong, it was the subject's job to administer an electric shock. With this scenario, Milgram could order the subject to increase voltage and administer shocks to see how far each subject would go. Milgram himself believed in the inherent goodness of humans. He believed the average person would refuse to deliver the shocks very early on. Milgram was incredibly disappointed. What his experiments have found time and time again, duplicated in many countries with generally the same results, is that the average person will continue to follow orders and administer what they believe are electric shocks again and again and again. They will defer to authority and ignore their own consciences, turning the dial to triple X voltage and continue to shock total strangers, even when the strangers beg them to stop, or complain of chest pains, or say they have heart trouble. In fact, Milgram got subjects to continue delivering shocks after the total stranger complained of chest pains and then went silent, since silence, according to the experiment, was a wrong answer. The average person hit the button again and again and again. They did what they were told to do rather than doing what they knew to be right and just and humane. They were good Germans, following orders, marching in lockstep like little Eichmanns. These findings are extremely disturbing. But I would suggest to you they are not at all surprising, given what we know of this mental illness called hierarchy. Consider that hierarchy distorts us from birth, demanding that we defer to authority. We are trained to do as we are told, to sublimate our own thoughts and ideas and feelings, our own wants and desires and aspirations, and to obey the directives of another, to the benefit of the greater program. When our internal compass points in a different direction from the authorities, we defer to the cop's badge, the priest's collar, the judge's gavel, the doctor's lab coat. We follow orders and we suck it up. That's how we're trained. It's what hierarchy demands. So looking at it this way, it would be really surprising if anyone in Milgram's experiments refused, disobeyed, rebelled. That would be outside the norms of the hierarch pathology. Through this lens, the Nazis and their blind obedience to orders, even to the commission of atrocities and crimes against humanity, are not some aberration, some departure from the hierarch program we call civilization. As disturbing as this might be to acknowledge, the Nazi death camps might just be the purest expression of the hierarch program ever manifested. With its efficiency and mindless obedience to orders, the death camps were not a deviation from hierarch civilization, but were instead the hierarch pathology on steroids. Presidents, generals, and CEOs daily strive to duplicate such unwavering loyalty and obedience in their subjects and soldiers and workers. At any rate, whether intended or not, Milgram's experiments proved conclusively how completely the indoctrination and programming we suffer as we're forcibly shaped into deluded hierarchs really makes us incapable of acting as moral agents. It turns us into war criminals waiting orders. Don't ever let the hierarchs, social engineers, convince you otherwise. There's no such thing as a healthy respect for authority. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility in Lucasville. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain 243-205, P.O. Box 45699, 1724 State Route number 728, Lucasville, Ohio 45699. To read some of Sean's writing and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org.
Will you first introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do?
Yes, and thank you so much for inviting me to share this time with you and your listeners. My name is Hillary, and I currently work at an organization called the Center for Popular Democracy, which is a national network of community-based organizations working for racial justice and economic justice, immigrant rights. And I've been doing sort of social justice work for a long time, but that included several years that I spent in Chiapas, Mexico, working with Zapatista communities in indigenous villages, and specifically with women's projects. So I feel like it's all connected because, you know, whether it's here in the U.S. or whether it's, you know, abroad, I feel like it's all one kind of vision of a world of greater justice and greater dignity. And then the book that I wrote came out of that experience working with women's cooperatives and women's projects in Zapatista communities.
So you went to Chiapas through your work?
Not in the sense of for a job. Like, I went to Chiapas actually in 1997 thinking that I was just going to stay for a couple weeks or maybe a couple months. So I was there originally as a human rights observer and as a volunteer on solidarity projects. But it was such a compelling movement and such a fascinating time. I felt like history was kind of unfolding before my eyes, and how could I not stay and witness it or be part of it in some way? So I ended up staying, and I stayed on, and I ended up staying about 6 years. So much longer than I had expected.
Yeah.
But so I was there from 1997 till 2003. So I've been back in the U.S. for a little more than 10 years doing what I consider to be the same work, but it's not actually like I was working for the same organization or anything.
I do want to talk to you more about your time in Chiapas in a later question, but just to lay some solid groundwork for any listeners who are unfamiliar, would you be willing to talk us through some historical bullet points of the Zapatista movement?
Yeah, of course. So the Zapatista movement is also called the EZLN, which is a Spanish acronym for the Zapatista Army of National Liberation. It's primarily social movement, a very broad grassroots radical social movement in southern Mexico, fighting for indigenous rights, for land, but for also for a whole kind of host of broader demands that I think are very universal in a sense of for dignity, for justice, for equality, for democracy, and have really resonated with people around the world. So in addition to being a social movement, it also has a rebel army. So they did choose the path of armed struggle after many years of fighting for change in their own context, they sort of, out of a sense of desperation, seeing children die from preventable diseases, for example, they chose the path of armed struggle, feeling like they had no option left but to stand up for themselves and force the government to listen. The communities in Chiapas are historically extremely poor, extremely marginalized, and that's really a legacy from colonialism. So the history of racism, the history of economic exploitation, all of that goes back, you know, more than 500 years. And those legacies are still things that those communities are facing today. So the Zapatista movement comes out of that history of 500 plus years of indigenous resistance. It also comes out of the legacy of the Mexican Revolution. So the name Zapatista comes from Zapata. Emiliano Zapata was a hero of the Mexican Revolution who fought for Tierra y Libertad, land and freedom. So they very much carried on that banner, but they also recognize that neoliberalism or global capitalism, whichever you want to call it, is kind of the current political and economic system which reproduces many of those same legacies of inequality, of injustice, and of exploitation that began with colonialism. So they actually rose up in arms on January 1st, 1994, and that was the same day that NAFTA, which is the North American Free Trade Agreement, went into effect. And they chose that day to highlight that relationship with global capitalism, with neoliberalism. So that's when many of us around the world first heard of the Zapatistas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for myself, speaking personally, it was really an important moment. It came kind of at the tail end of the Cold War. So there was this kind of question in the air for people of my generation. I was, you know, 19 at the time in 1994, of what the kind of next wave of social movements would look like after the end of the Cold War. And, you know, the capitalists were claiming victory of, you know, it was going to be free trade, the market won. And so it was really inspiring to see this model of, this example of what a new social movement might look like. And it's really inspired people ever since then. So that was 20 plus years ago. After that very brief armed uprising, the Zapatistas have not used their weapons ever since then. So they've become known. They do still have an insurgent army. And that's, I think, an important thing to know about them in terms of it impacts their character as a very militant movement. But it's also, in reality, it's much more of a broad social movement in terms of its actions, and has become much more known for peaceful mobilizations, for political marches and other actions, for convening civil society, Mexican and as well as international civil society, to come together and talk about the different problems that we face, different strategies of how we can find solutions collectively and build a world of greater dignity and justice. It's also become very known for its project of indigenous autonomy. So in its own territory, in eastern Chiapas, they've developed autonomous governments, their own health care and education systems. They have a whole system of economic cooperatives, which have developed an economy that's based on cooperation and solidarity rather than one that's based on profit.
I was really struck by, because there's lots of parts in your book and a lot of it's interview based, but I remember reading in your book that the Zapatistas would come down from the mountains posing as, you know, teachers or whoever and just start talking to people. And it's so much an emphasis on people talking to each other and being like, why are you so poor? Why don't you have as much to eat as you need? Like, why do you need to do all this work trying to get people's wheels turning?
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that same concept that you're pointing out of dialogue, I think has been really important within the Zapatista movement, but also, you know, when I mentioned convening civil society at the national or international level, I think that same concept of dialogue that you're describing has really been important in terms of how the Zapatistas have engaged with people around Mexico and around the world, and that same process of listening to each other, of asking questions that really make each other think, you know, why is this injustice the case? You know, what can we do about it? And so I think that's been one of the ways that's been so effective for them to spark people responding by organizing in their own contexts around the world.
And it seems like those conversations were extremely non-coercive, meaning that people were like, oh, there's this meeting where people are talking about it. Come to it if you want.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. You know, so when I mentioned 1994 was the Zapatista uprising, the very brief uprising, they had actually been organizing clandestinely for 10 years before that. So from 1983 to 1994, 1983 is when the EZLN was formed in the mountains or the jungles of Chiapas. And so for the next 10 years, they were doing exactly what you're describing, you know, talking to people in the villages, asking them questions, encouraging them to organize. There was very strong movement in Chiapas. Like I mentioned, people turned to armed struggle because they had already been, you know, many people who became Zapatistas had been engaged for years and years in campesino movements, for example, or indigenous rights movements, asking for land reform from the government, for example, and really seeing no response and just living, like they describe, the Zapatistas often refer to themselves and have been called the voice of the voiceless. So it's really this sense of this very, very marginalized, kind of forgotten corner of Mexico and people making this decision to take their own destiny into their own hands. And so I think when the original kind of the core guerrilla nucleus that formed in 1983 began to really reach out to people in the villages, it just was a very kind of fertile moment for people to say, yes, you know, it's time. We need to take this to a whole other level and demand our rights and do that in a determined and courageous way.
I'd love to talk a little bit about your book, which is called Compañeras Zapatista Women's Stories, and it is heavily interview-based, drawn from interviews, many of which you conducted yourself with people who directly experienced working with the EZLN, and you mentioned that you lived in Chiapas itself from 1997 to 2003. Would you talk a little bit more about your time living in Zapatista communities in Chiapas?
Like I mentioned, you know, when I went down there, I wasn't planning to stay for so long. But one of the reasons, when I mentioned earlier that I felt like history was kind of unfolding before my eyes, the Zapatista movement in itself was incredibly inspiring to me at that time. I mean, it still is, but when I got there and I was so struck by it. But in particular, the role of women has always been crucial. And I think this is true for many social movements. And this had been my experience personally, as well as something I had studied, was the experience of women within many social movements, where on the one hand, there's this opportunity and you are engaged in this whole new way. And at the same time, even within that social movement, women have had to fight for their own rights within that to defend themselves. And so I had had this kind of longstanding interest in women's participation in radical and revolutionary social movements. And so when I got to Chiapas, it was that particular aspect of history that was, like I said, sort of unfolding before my eyes, where on the one hand, women have played a critical role in the Zapatista movement from the very beginning, and at the same time have had to push for a lot of changes internally. And there was a lot that was still evolving and unfolding. So I was very struck by that combination of these amazing, strong, courageous, inspiring women leaders, and also, you know, the participation of women within the Zapatista movement was continuing to evolve. And so that was kind of what compelled me to stay for so much longer. I got involved with the women's cooperatives in particular because it's an economic space for women to generate resources collectively and invest those resources back into their communities. But it's also, because it's an all-women space, there are all-women's collectives and all-men's collectives, that really stems from, because gender division of labor still exists to a large degree. So women's collectives tend to be artisan collectives or vegetable gardens or chicken-raising collectives. And because they're all-women spaces, they're also really an area where women oftentimes kind of come to voice, come to their own sense of power for the first time. It's the first time they might be participating outside of the home or learning to speak up. So it's kind of like a springboard for women's involvement in other ways in the Zapatista movement. So that was the kind of work that I was drawn to. And this coworker and I developed a project kind of hand in hand with the Zapatista women leaders, their kind of regional representatives. And so we had sort of an ongoing conversation with them about what might be useful and what would be helpful for us to do as outsiders, and developed this project of supporting women's cooperatives and women's regional organizing in general. And so that was what I did for most of the time that I was there in Chiapa.
Apart from artisanal stuff like and vegetable gardening, what were some of the projects that the women's collective did?
They're each organized around whatever different economic activity they decide. I mean, this is just one way that women are organized, but in particular, as economic cooperatives, the women often talk about, you know, the first step is to get together as a women's meeting or a women's assembly and decide to form a cooperative, and then decide what type of cooperative they want to form. So they might decide, for example, to start a vegetable garden or to start a chicken raising collective, and they'll each contribute something like 1 peso each to buy seeds and start the vegetable garden, or they each contribute 1 hen, and then that's how they start the chicken raising collective. Some of the ones that are most common, I mean, those ones that we mentioned, the artisan cooperative, tend to be for outside consumption, so they sell more to an external market. A lot of the other ones are really more geared towards internal consumption. So even as they're generating resources, they're also, with the vegetable gardens, for example, they're addressing malnourishment in their communities. That's a big source of health problem because people have historically had a pretty limited diet. In addition to generating those resources, they're also producing kind of for local consumption. Another example of that, sometimes the women open collective stores, and because some of these villages are very isolated, then it also allows people in the villages to buy from a local store instead of having to travel just for sort of basic goods. So individuals don't have to travel 2 or 4 or 6 hours to the closest city, but the cooperative store does that buying and selling. So it's making a little bit of money, but it's also providing that service to the local community. And then the women collectively decide how they want to spend those resources. So they might be responding to emergencies, like if one woman is very sick, they can help her out, or if there's a political mobilization, or they might decide to invest in the autonomous school. So there's a lot of different ways, but that decision-making process also is very important. It's another way that is kind of very empowering for the women who are involved to be kind of engaged in, okay, we've generated these resources, now, you know, what do we want to do with that, those resources that we've generated?
The issue of food is so important because it seems that so many of the women that you interviewed are indigenous women and who were, like, born into what I might call, like, a kind of indentured servitude. Is that completely inaccurate? And like, food was a very, very restricted resource for people who were subsistence farming to sustain themselves, but they were given, for the most part, infertile land or like land that just nothing would grow on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, some of what we were talking about earlier in terms of the legacies of colonialism have to do exactly with what you're talking about, where the land that historically had belonged to indigenous peasants was basically stolen from them. And ever since colonialism has existed, has been really concentrated in the hands of a very few wealthy families in Chiapas that are basically European descended. And even though there have been some stages of land reform in Mexican history, and some of the biggest kind of, they're called fincas, and in a lot of parts of Latin America they're called haciendas. In Chiapas they're called fincas. They're basically like large plantations. You know, when we think about the South in the United States, for example, the plantations, the historic kind of cotton picking plantations, that type of economy, where in Chiapas they weren't literally slaves, but like you said, they were basically like indentured servants. And so even though those kind of exact same structures didn't exist anymore, it looked very similar in terms of, like you said, the indigenous peasants having either to live and work full-time on these fincas, or else they have these very small plots of land, you know, up kind of on the rocky mountainside where basically nothing grew. And so land and the food that they produced was just a huge source of inequity, or sort of a manifestation of that inequity, the injustice that people were living with. And so people actually talk about the hunger months, el tiempo de hambre, when their corn had run out from one season and they hadn't harvested the corn from the next season. So there was this kind of gap in between where they just literally didn't have enough to eat. So that's kind of historically what people were dealing with. And so, yeah, it was just so very, very kind of core to people's lives and people's experiences.
You mentioned that you came over to Chiapas. Could you speak about writing on this topic from the perspective of a relative outsider? Could you talk about how that influenced your approach?
So at the tail end of the time that I was there, one of the projects that I worked on before I left was an internal document where the women wanted to record their own stories. And I think Zapatista women recognize that they've been part of something pretty historic, and they wanted to kind of record that for themselves, but they also really wanted to use it as a tool for education, for organizing with other women. And so I did that project, which was really amazing. And you mentioned earlier that a lot of the book is heavily based on interviews that I did with different women. And so a lot of the interviews were kind of throughout the time that I was there, but a lot of them were particularly from this time period when I was doing this project with the women that was initially just for themselves. But once we finished it and they have this kind of product, which was like a popular education manual. And like I said, it was really geared towards them not only having their own stories documented, but being able to kind of use it to educate and organize other women. They themselves said, you know what, we actually really want to share these stories with an outside world as well. And how do you feel about doing something like this book, but for an outside audience? And I tell that whole story because I feel like your question is coming from this really important place of what is the role of an outsider in writing a book like this. And you know, I had spent several years at that point working very closely with the Zapatistas, very much always as an outsider, right? It's not my community, it's not my context, but I was very close with the communities at that point, and I would not have felt like it was appropriate for me to go and publish this book or share their stories if it hadn't been specifically a request or a suggestion that came originally from them. And then, you know, I felt like it was important personally because in this country, so much has been written about the Zapatistas, but very little about women, and even less kind of in their own words. So even though it is my book, I felt like my role was much more as a cultural bridge to create sort of a vehicle for women to share their own stories. So the book contains a lot of my own writing where I kind of introduce the women or I share kind of historical background or some context. But my intention was always to do that as a foundation for an outside audience to be able to then engage with the women's stories from having the necessary background, but then to hear really directly from them. So like you said, the book is very heavily based on these interviews, and that was really the most important thing to me. And so just going back more concretely to your question, I think that I, as an outsider, did have the ability to kind of create that bridge, especially in an audience, you know, in this country, but like I said, very much coming from a commitment to create the space for the women to kind of tell their own stories and people to hear as directly as possible, just because I had been so incredibly touched and moved and inspired by all these women that I had worked with over the years and their stories of transformation, their stories of struggle, their stories of courage had been so meaningful to me that it was just, when they were the ones that suggested that to me, it was such kind of an honor to think of me creating that kind of vehicle for them to share their stories with a broader audience.
Yeah, for sure. And as speaking as another outsider, it was really amazing to be able to read their experiences in their own words. So I've strongly benefited from that. And it's a pretty incredible experience to be able to do that.
I mean, the fact that you had that experience of it makes me feel like, you know, I sort of accomplished that task that I set out to do.
And it's amazing that because Zapatismo has so many, like you said, visible female leaders, like Comandanta Ramona comes to mind, that there hasn't been much written about Zapatista women.
Yeah, no, I mean, there has been some stuff written for sure. There is stuff out there. But relative to how much has been written overall about the Zapatista movement, I feel like there was a real gap. You know, and like I said, even what's been written kind of about Zapatista women, I feel like hasn't been, so I really felt like it was important to fill that need.
This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. We're speaking with Hillary Klein about her book, Compañeras, Zapatista Women's Stories. You're listening to Asheville FM at WSFMLP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. More after this musical break. El camino marcará.
sapatita.
Will you speak to the political roots of Zapatismo? It seemed to me that there were some strongly Maoist, communist, and militaristic currents in there. And since this is an anarchist radio show, I feel like I should ask that question and to like clarify that for the listening audience.
Sure. Yeah, no, one thing I think that is very fascinating, and I think specifically from an anarchist perspective, that Zapatismo, I would say, is a blend of many different political traditions, political and also historical and cultural traditions that didn't come out specifically of an anarchist trajectory, but ends up having a lot in common with anarchism. So, you know, I think anarchists around the world have really related to the Zapatistas because of some of these core principles that the Zapatistas have come to represent, including not trying to take state power, that they instead believe in kind of creating power from below, creating alternative institutions to the state, and having this very sort of horizontal, a lot of very horizontal structures. And then, you know, all the stuff that we were talking about the indigenous autonomy, and having a critique, for example, you know, not only of the state, but of the whole kind of political system. And they've been very clear about they're not going to turn into a political party, which was the path that many Central American guerrilla movements, for example, eventually converted into political parties. But in terms of the roots, which you were asking about, so that's all to say that I think, you know, the end product of Zapatismo has a lot in common with anarchism, but it came from all these very different places and or sort of political historical roots. You know, I think one of the things that I think is so unique and to the Zapatistas' credit has been their ability to draw the best of different political traditions. So there was, you know, we were talking a little bit earlier about the history of the Zapatista movement, but there was this kind of core nucleus of Marxist guerrillas that came out of the student movement in the 60s and the 70s throughout Mexico. They went down and formed that initial guerrilla nucleus that we were talking about in 1983, but they really began to interact with the campesino movements, the indigenous movements in Chiapas at the time, with the Catholic Church, which was very heavily kind of influenced by liberation theology. They were, like you said, there was Maoist groups down there at the time. And I think what the Zapatistas were able to do was to sort of blend all that into something that was kind of new and unique and I would now call Zapatismo, but came from these very different political threads. I think a lot of the more sort of horizontal aspect came from the history of the indigenous communities themselves. And so the Zapatistas' ability, the original core of Zapatistas who were not from Chiapas, which, you know, were only a handful of people, really. I mean, numerically speaking, the Zapatista movement is pretty much all indigenous peasants from Chiapas. But there was this original group that came from elsewhere to kind of start at that time. Their vision was a much more like the vision of the Cuban Revolution. In some of the really poetic writing about the Zapatistas themselves, have how they've described themselves, Marcos, for example, who is a male non-indigenous leader but was the spokesperson for the Zapatista movement for many years, he talks very eloquently about that process of the kind of indigenization of the Zapatista army in some ways. So if people are interested, you know, I definitely encourage them to sort of look up some of those writings or kind of descriptions of that process are very fascinating.
Apparently, I heard that Subcomandante Marcos, who is like the leader, kind of like the leader of the Zapatista movement, abolished himself as a subcomandante. Did you hear about that? And is that true?
It is true. No, it is true. It's funny because he, I don't mean this to sound dismissive. I feel like everything he does, he sort of has to do with a flourish. So even the way that you describe it is like, he abolished himself. He basically, the sort of in practical terms, what he was doing was kind of passing on the reins to other indigenous leaders, which I think is great. Like, it was time for that to happen. The indigenous communities had chosen Marcos as their spokesperson, I think very legitimately recognizing that he would be able to play the role of reaching out to the world. And he's a very poetic, very philosophical, charismatic, kind of articulate leader. And at the same time, it feels right that it was time to kind of pass on those reins to the local indigenous leadership. So it was about a year ago, he said that Marcos had died and reemerged as Galeano. Galeano was the name of a man who was killed about a year ago in an attack against one of the Zapatista communities. And so he renamed himself Galeano kind of in honor of this person who had been killed. And at the same time said, you know, that it was time for him to kind of pass this on to other leadership. So there is a new subcomandante who now has that role. It's kind of an interesting dual role of military leader and spokesperson. So he's not actually, the subcomandante is not actually the political leader of the EZLN. There's a political body of leaders, which is kind of chosen by all the different communities. There's kind of a different layers of each community has an assembly, and then each region has an assembly, and they kind of choose their representatives at each of those levels. So at the highest level are the political comandantes, which is the collective body of leadership, of political leadership of the EZLN. And actually the subcomandante is called subcomandante because he is under their direct command. So the military leadership is underneath the command of the political leadership. But because he's also the spokesperson, it's the person that people most often kind of associate with the Zapatista movement. You know, and then speaking like what we were speaking about earlier in terms of not hearing from women, I mean, part of that is because there has been this one person who's been kind of the most well-known leader of the Zapatista movement who also happens to be a man. You know, it's just, that's like the one Zapatista that if people have generally heard of one Zapatista, it's usually Subcomandante Marcos.
You write in chapter one of your book that the injustices that people faced were the roots of the Zapatista revolutionary movement. To that end, would you describe general conditions that the women you spoke to faced before the influence of the Zapatistas?
Yeah, definitely. So Comandante Esther, who is another one of the really kind of powerful women Zapatista leaders, she one time spoke before the Mexican Congress in 2001. And it was actually the first time an indigenous woman had ever spoken to the Mexican Congress, which by itself is startling. So she spoke to the Mexican Congress, and she talked about women in Chiapas being exploited or oppressed three times over. She said, first, because we're poor, second, because we're indigenous, and third, because we're women. Mm-hmm. And I think that really gets at the heart of, you know, we were already talking about some of the legacies of colonialism. So, you know, indigenous women deal with all of that, right? They deal with the racism, they deal with the poverty, they deal with the economic exploitation, but then they also deal with the gender discrimination. And the way you framed it is before the influence of the Zapatista movement, just in sort of an extraordinary level of lack of rights, in the sense that they were pretty much confined to their home, couldn't leave their home without the permission from their husband or their father. From the very time they were girls, were basically told they didn't have rights, they didn't have a voice. You know, their role was just to work in the home, to take care of kids. And that's obviously a very important, dignified work, like raising children and taking care of the home, but it's not something that, you know, that I believe women should be limited to. So, you know, and then in terms of the family life, women were married very young, oftentimes against their will. When they were maybe 13 or 14 years old, their father would, you know, arrange a marriage for them, basically. And then women oftentimes had, you know, 10, 12, sometimes 15 kids, and so had very little kind of control over their own lives, their own bodies, the decisions that impacted their lives. And then the realm of sort of public decision-making was really dominated by men. So that was kind of, you know, when Zapatista women, the older women, this is what their lives were. They oftentimes talk about, you know, the first chapter of the book is called something like Stories of Our Mothers or Our Grandmothers, because they oftentimes refer to these are the stories that our mothers or our grandmothers have told us, but, you know, including the Zapatista women who are still around today, but this is kind of what they grew up with, was just this really intense level of of discrimination and marginalization.
I had a thought because I remember reading an interview with one person. I don't remember what her name was, but she basically described the difference between like societal men's work and women's work. And she said that the men's work is hard, yes, but people get to take breaks and we never really get to take breaks. And we have like our, you know, like you said, our 13 children, like two babies on our hips, grinding flour for tortillas and getting water and cleaning the house and like doing all sorts of odd jobs and also caring for many, many children and not ever getting to take a break. And people often were just ill a lot from overwork and malnourishment and all that stuff. So I found that really striking.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of extraordinary. And, you know, like you said, in terms of just the women's workday, they talk about the kind of double workday that, you know, I think women in this country still experience the sort of expectation that after a day's work, you come home and women are still largely expected to be the ones kind of doing primary childcare and taking care of the home. But it was to such an extreme degree, like you said, you know, women were basically working nonstop from the moment that they woke up to the moment that they went to bed, and oftentimes would go out to the fields and work side by side with the men. So that was, you know, quote unquote men's work, was really like working in the fields. But then once men were done that day of work, they would kind of come home and rest, whereas the women would come home and then continue to do all the other work that they were doing, the domestic work and everything else that you were describing.
So we're talking about a lot of like positive aspects of the EZLN, and there are many, many, many of them. But since it's an organization that's run by people and people are flawed and all of this stuff, I wanted to bring up a quote that I was struck by on page 95, which goes, quote, "Women's right to own or inherit land has not been staunchly defended by Zapatista authorities in the ways that their equal right to political participation has." Will you speak about the cultural and social aspects of this dispute?
Yeah, so, you know, when we were talking earlier about how important land is, you know, it's important to the indigenous communities of Chiapas economically because it is the source of kind of food and of income. It's also, as indigenous people, it's really important to them culturally, spiritually, this concept of Mother Earth, and they don't think of land as private property. So the Zapatistas carried out a bunch of land takeovers in 1994 in the same context as the uprising. One of the other actions that they took was these land occupations, and then they redistributed these fincas that we were talking about before to indigenous presence, you know, Zapatistas throughout the state of Chiapas. And that was made a huge difference in people's lives. You know, when we were talking earlier also about the hunger month, when people didn't have enough crops to literally kind of feed themselves throughout the year, people living on this retaken land, this land was much more fertile. You know, they had more access to more land, and that made just a huge difference in people's lives in terms of their kind of economic livelihood, in terms of their food security, and again, in terms of their identity as indigenous people, it's culturally, spiritually, and just having a territorial base has been super important to the Zapatista movement in terms of having kind of an area of land where they are experimenting with all these other aspects of society, the kind of the society that they're building. And so all of that has been very important. And, you know, like I said, that they don't think of land as private property, but it is still divided. So individuals will just have, will work on a particular parcel of land. And so they don't own that land, but that's their kind of parcel of land to farm on. And the Zapatistas, I think it's one of the few areas where, you know, like you said in that quote, it compared to women political participation, the EZLN as an organization has very staunchly defended women's right to be involved in the movement at all levels. But with the access to land, it hasn't been. And it's actually one of the few areas that stood out to me where the EZLN, I believe, could have been more proactive and hasn't been. And so they've kind of reproduced some of the gendered assumptions that women don't need access to land in the same way. And so when they have divided up, for example, this land that they took over, they divided up those individual parcels primarily to men. And then it was up to, it's mostly individual families to decide as they pass land on to the next generation, if they would pass it on kind of equally to the sons, to the daughters, or just to the son. When we were talking earlier about women fighting for their rights within different social movements, they've continued to push, and it is kind of an internal debate, and I think there's been a lot of movement around it. There's been definitely a shift has taken place, but I think we haven't seen as big as a shift there in terms of access to land for women or equally between women and men as we have seen some really pretty incredible shifts in other types of transformations that women have experienced. So I think it's just a fascinating example of no movement is perfect, none of us as individuals are perfect, and our social movements aren't perfect either. For me personally, it's one of the few areas that I think New Zealand could have taken a more kind of proactive stand on in terms of women's agrarian rights.
Yeah, I mean, these kinds of social, societal changes happen so slowly, you know, and revolutionizing the way that we overthrow misogyny in ourselves and in our communities, I think will be a thing that will last the entirety of humans lasting, however long that may be. On the note of some of the more positive social changes that the EZLN brought about, one of the more striking changes of the organization was the Women's Revolutionary Law, which was shared publicly after 1994. Will you speak about this law and about its role in Zapatista history?
So the Women's Revolutionary Law was written and passed by the EZLN in 1993, kind of leading up to the uprising, and then they shared it publicly, like you said, after the uprising in 1994. But I think it was, you know, it was a very important document, and I'll talk in a second about what it actually, you know, some of what it contains. Mm-hmm. But I think it was very important both in terms of all the work that went into it and then all the work that has happened since then to implement it. So this one kind of point in time when it was passed, but also represents, like you were saying a second ago, that change takes time. And so it was in all the kind of the years before and after. So in the kind of the late 80s and early 90s, like when we were talking earlier about the clandestine organizing that the EZLN was doing in the communities, one very important aspect of that was, and in particular, oftentimes it was women insurgents who were talking to women in the different villages and really sort of instigating that same sense of kind of asking about injustice that we were talking about earlier. Women were doing that kind of specifically around women's rights and around gender discrimination and asking women, do you think life really has to be like this? How else could life look like? And so all these women's assemblies and talks and conversations went into creating the Women's Revolutionary Law. So there was the political leaders as well as the military leaders, early women leaders in that time, really kind of carried out this series of conversations, and that was what became the Women's Revolutionary Law. So they drew up all of those kind of proposals into this document. It was passed by the political leadership, the comandantes, in 1993, and it became really kind of a framing document regarding what women's rights in Zapatista territory are. So in terms of what it actually says, it talks about women's right to participate in the movement at all levels. So that gets at their political participation, their leadership in their communities, their ability to be military leaders in the Zapatista rebel army. But it also talks about a very broad kind of range of areas of life. And so it talks about women's right to healthcare and education. It talks about women's right to live free of violence. It talks about women's right to decide who to marry and how many children to have. So it really addresses kind of across both public and private spheres, you know, family life, community life, political life. And, you know, in some ways those rights are very basic, but putting each of them into practice is hugely transformative. So then, you know, once the law was passed, like I said, the work that then came to implement it was, you know, work of consciousness raising, work of education, work of changing those family norms. But I do think if you look at each one of the points in the Revolutionary Women's Law, there has been huge transformation that's taken place. And so I think it's so important that you asked earlier about what were women's lives like before the Zapatista movement, because that helps give us an understanding of just how extraordinary those transformations were. So, you know, from that situation that, you know, that the women describe themselves, their mothers, their grandmothers living in, to what Zapatista women have achieved in really an incredibly short period of time. So, you know, on the one hand, I totally agree with what you said a second ago about patriarchy and you know, that it's something that it takes a huge amount of time to uproot. And I can't really fault the Zapatistas for not having ended patriarchy in the 20 years that they've been at it, because I don't think anywhere in the world, you know, like you said, I don't think there's been sort of anywhere that patriarchy has been completely, you know, uprooted.
Oh, yeah, that'd be such a tall order.
Right. And if there is somewhere out there and, you know, your listeners know of that place, please let me know.
You'll be the first to know, definitely.
That would be great. Maybe one of your listeners will call in and let us know. This is where patriarchy has been uprooted. Anyway, but there was a huge amount of transformation that took place in this very short time period in types of changes that I think in many contexts take sort of generations to unfold. And so the level of women's political participation, the level of their leadership in the movement, the changes that have taken place in the home, you know, I think those points of the revolutionary law have really, to a large degree, been implemented. Women choosing, you know, if they want to marry at all, and if they do, who they settle down with, how many children they have. So, you know, there's a lot of work to be done, but there's also just a tremendous amount that's been accomplished. And, you know, that I think is also really at the heart of why I wanted to publish this book and why I wanted to create that vehicle for women to tell their own stories, because not only are those transformations so incredible, but I think there's so many lessons to be learned of, you know, it is a very different context, but what it can look like, what it can mean, you know, to accomplish those types of transformations in our own lives.
Obviously, the EZLN has had a lot of international effects on people. Will you speak to some of the impacts that this movement has had on radical and anarchist societies in other countries, especially concerning the involvement of women? And to what extent do you see it still having an effect?
Oh, definitely. I do really believe that ever since 1994, the Zapatista movement has been one of the most impactful social movements around the world that has just had a tremendous kind of ripple effect in terms of influencing and inspiring people around the world. And, you know, I think there are some really concrete examples of that. And at the same time, I think it's really hard to measure, but just kind of undeniably out there.
So one of those really concrete examples is the anti-globalization movement of the late 1990s. So if folks remember or, you know, have heard of the protests in Seattle against the World Trade Organization or some of the other mobilizations that were taking place around the world, that really was something the Zapatista helped plant the seeds of that movement in some of those gatherings that I was talking about earlier, that the Zapatistas have acted kind of as conveners of those conversations. So they invited people to their territory, and people came throughout Mexico, but really from all over the world, and they really put this call out for anyone who's been negatively impacted by global capitalism. So whether that's because you are a student or a worker or a housewife or a transgender person or whatever the case may be, and that's, you know, when I was talking earlier about the kind of their demands being very universal, but I think it's also been that type of call of, you know, anyone who has been exploited, oppressed, you know, who's been, who's faced injustice. And so many different people of so many different walks of life responded to that call. And so, you know, many of those different folks. And so in the late 90s, the focus of that was really kind of in the context of neoliberalism and thinking about how can we kind of address that. And so the anti-globalization movement of the late 90s, I think, really kind of, it wasn't the only thing, but it was one of the things that really helped plant those seeds. So that's, I think, you know, one concrete example. But there's just been, besides that, there's so many different collectives, organizations, groups around the world that have been influenced by the Zapatistas. It's like it's hard to name or kind of measure that impact, but I do feel like it's just kind of, it's intangible but undeniable, and I think young people today continue to be inspired by the Zapatistas. You know, they're not in the spotlight in the same way they were kind of 10, 15, 20 years ago, but, you know, I continue to hear constantly about different examples of people who are really influenced by the Zapatistas, inspired by them, and then concretely influenced by them. And in terms of women, you know, I think it's just been, it has been a really key example of not only having a movement that has strong women leadership, but a movement that's also been able to evolve. And when we were talking earlier about the roots of Zapatismo, and I was saying that one of the things that, that makes the Zapatistas somewhat unique, I think, is their ability to kind of draw from different political traditions and kind of be fluid and adapt. And I think that their approach to gender is an example of that. So even though, you know, on the one hand, they were always committed to women's participation, but there has also been a real evolution of what of their sort of gender analysis, and that they would not use the word feminist. It's just like a, it's not kind of the term they would use, but I think they have developed a much more nuanced analysis of gender and really taken on this question of what does it look like to uproot patriarchy. So yes, it will take time, but there's been kind of a whole new series of strategies to address patriarchy, to really uproot it. And I think that that is so inspiring and is something that, that many of us in different social movements around the world can still really look to as, you know, as a model of, you know, there's a lot that we've won, but there's a lot more to do. And, you know, I think the Zapatistas, for me personally, women, the Zapatista women in particular, but one of the aspects of the Zapatista movement that I think is, it really kind of resonates is this combination of, on the one hand, being kind of humble enough to know that they don't have all the answers. So they have this very much a kind of a philosophy of making the road by walking and constructing the world of justice and dignity that they want to live in, building that step by step, you know, stone by stone. And so I think that humility is really important to know that we don't have all the answers. Nobody has all the answers. But at the same time, having kind of the chutzpah to having the kind of the courage to say that's not going to stop us from dreaming big and from taking on global capitalism or from, you know, declaring war on the Mexican government. And for women, you know, it's not going to stop them from, you know, asking how do we address patriarchy and how do we take all this stuff on. So I think that combination, that humility combined with the kind of courage to dream big and act on those dreams, is the one kind of thing that I would like to kind of leave your listeners with. And I think that message is true in general, but for me as a woman, I would say in particular for women, that's, you know, women engaged in other struggles where it's all connected, right? That as women's rights are connected to economic justice and social justice and racial justice. And as we fight for all those things in this interconnected way, that's kind of the message that, if there was one thing I would choose that I would like to share, what I took away from those years that I spent in Chiapas and what I kind of hope to convey in the book, that would be it.
Hillary Klein, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about your book, Compañeras, Zapatista Women's Stories, which is available from Seven Stories Press, and I highly, highly recommend it. It's a really, really good read, and I learned a lot from it. Thank you so much for talking with me today. It's been a super...
Thank you so much. Oh, yeah, it was such a pleasure chatting with you.
You're listening to Asheville FM at WSFMLP at 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw.